Daniel Libeskind is considered one of today's most dynamic and innovative architects. His latest book, Counterpoint, Daniel Libeskind in Conversation with Paul Goldberger, displays some of his most celebrated works, including his designs for the master plan for the World Trade Center, from initial sketch to construction. It's published by the Monticelli Press, and I'm delighted that it brings Daniel Libeskind back to the show today. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you so much.
You've said that you see architecture as a narrative. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I think architecture, like everything else, has to tell a story. It's not just – every building does tell a story. Even the worst building tells you that it has nothing to tell you. So it's about communicating something.
It says I'm boring.
I'm boring or I'm dull. But every building, I think, is a compelling entity to communicate something about the past, about the present, where we're going, and so on.
You also include a lot of symbolism in the work. There, we have the 1776-foot tower at Ground Zero, 48 concrete pillars representing the birth of Israel at the Jewish Museum in Berlin. Do you think that about the symbolism and the meaning of the structure before you start designing?
No, I think you design, but I think symbols are important because we live by symbols. Everything in life, including language, is symbolic. So architecture has to incorporate, especially big public buildings, public spaces that need sort of to resonate with the mind.
Can you describe the design process? Where does each project start? I know in your case it starts with drawing on paper. Most architects today actually start on a computer, don't they?
I don't know, but I still draw on paper. It's a very old-fashioned thing. But
the old-fashioned way.
But there's nothing to replace that connection between the eye, the intuition, the mind, a line on a piece of paper. And, of course, you start by a meditation. You don't start with a, here, this is what I'm going to do. You meditate. And of course, out of that knowledge of the site, what is required, the light, the proportional systems that you're going to use, something emerges that is always surprising and takes you in its own direction.
You say you meditate. I would think that when you're given an assignment, somebody's commissioned you to do a building, you have a pretty good idea of what that building should be from the start based on what you're asked to do and what you've done in the past.
No. You do know what are the parameters of the building. You know the cost of the building. You know where it's going to be located. You know the program. But you don't know about the building. Designing a building is an adventure. If it was just a formula, I wouldn't really want to participate in it. It's discovering something in that maybe very prosaic brief that you're given and something that is original.
Well, how much input does the person who's commissioning the building and the developer have?
Well, I think the developer gives you the sort of objective parameters of a project. And you have to share their vision. If you're cynical about a developer, you shouldn't work with them. But if a developer is someone who is trying to do something, and as I mentioned in my book, you don't want the developer who knows everything, and also you don't want a developer who knows nothing. You want someone who sort of shares that vision.
Well, I've spoken to people who've written scripts for films who have talked about how they see something of what they had originally intended in the movie that finally comes out after all these other people have gotten involved and put their two cents in. Does that happen with a building as well?
Not really. You know, every person really knows about architecture. Every child, every person has grown. You know, we know about cities and buildings. So everybody has a preconceived idea of what it should look. But I think the role of architecture is actually to reverse those predictions and really to come up with something that opens a new horizon.
Do you think that computers and other new technologies have had a negative impact on architecture and design?
No, they have not had they can have a negative impact in the sense that people can press a button and create a building that is completely abstract and just has nothing to do with life. On the other hand, the possibility of using computers has made buildings that would have taken 200 years to build, you can build them now on time, within a budget, and reasonably.
Well, we did a segment on this show some years back in which we talked with the engineer who you work with. And we talked about how you would come up with an idea and then he would have to come up with the math, figure out the tensile strength of the steel and just how he could bend things to actually bring about what you had fantasized.
I think the beautiful things today is that architecture and engineering have come closer because we have the same equipment, so to speak, and we can work on the same three-dimensional models. So that kind of divide between engineering and architecture has come, I think, largely to an end. We can now almost build the things that we dream about.
My guest is Daniel Libeskind, whose latest book is actually Conversations with Paul Goldberger. It's published by the Monticelli Press. It's called Counterpoint. And this is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, by the way. Images from the book can be found on our show page at wnyc.org. Your work is very visible. It stands out from the surroundings, and yet you always take the surroundings into account when you create a design. Do you intend your work to make a statement rather than to blend in?
Well, blending in has never been my idea of life. I mean, life is about here I am. This is today.
That's a very New York idea, isn't it?
No,
because there are other cities where people do try. Or, well, one of the things we really love is Rockefeller Center, where the buildings all do have some kind of a blending in quality.
Well, the truth is that all context is a living context, and it's never inert. It's never just what we think it is. It's never sort of like a puppy dog to be caressed. It's something to contribute to enliven it, to enhance it. So I think the very idea of context is a continuity. And, of course, for that, you also need sometimes to wake the context up and say that once upon a time it was very original and radical even. You know, Rockefeller Center was a radical thing that was built. It wasn't just the context that we see it now.
And now it's been imitated to death.
It's been imitated, and yet it's Rockefeller Center. It's a beautiful place.
Well, sometimes Raymond Hood is a great architect, and he does it well. You know, we often I've read books that blame Mies van der Rohe for some really ugly architecture, but Mies van der Rohe designed wonderful buildings. It's not his fault that other people didn't do it as well.
That's absolutely true. I mean, the great architects are great architects because they cared for what they designed. The imitators very often just take it as if it was a given, and there's no exploration and there's no art in it.
And we were talking just a few minutes ago about Le Corbusier. Some people blame the worst housing projects in that buildings that have been knocked down because they didn't work on him, even though he didn't design them.
Although I have to say, Corbusier had some ideas that really didn't work, and he promoted ideas of, you know, getting rid of streets and getting rid of traffic and dividing people. So, you know, he has to take some blame for the ideological things that he passed on.
And now more and more we're demanding that streets not be eliminated.
Well, absolutely. I think we believe that there's something more wise in the ancient notion that a street is a civic space, a public space. Streets have to be beautiful. That's where people meet.
One of your buildings, the Military Museum in Dresden, is behind the historic walls, yet it juts up and out from the original structure. So you wanted to both blend in and also not blend in?
Well, I wanted to feature that the military in a democratic society in Germany is not something to hide behind old walls. It's to reveal it, to give people also the view of the city of Dresden, which suffered through the bombing and yet is a great European city. So I created a building that gives you the view and is juxtaposed to the historical fabric.
And then there's the Jewish Museum in Berlin. It stands next to the original Berlin Museum, but it looks and feels entirely different.
Well, there...
What's the narrative there?
Well, there is no continuity in Berlin when it comes to the city and to Jewish history and to civility. This is where the Holocaust came from. So I didn't want to blend into the context. I want to juxtapose across the sort of void of relationships. There is something to think about across an emptiness.
You've designed some striking skyscrapers. How does designing skyscrapers differ in approach to designing other structures?
It doesn't. You know, a skyscraper is not some special, thing. Of course, it has its own being. It has its own history from Sullivan and earlier into today. But you have to put the same care for architecture if you believe that a building is not just a product for consumption.
About 2 or 3 months after the terrible events at the World Trade Center, we had a number of people here, including some leading architects from major architectural firms, and they declared the skyscraper dead. They said nobody's going to build a building over 50 stories anymore. And now they're building them taller than ever.
Well, I was not one of them.
No.
I believe that New Yorkers
But I think the president of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, was here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, many of these firms just go with the wind, where the wind blows. But if you really think about sustainability, you think of density of cities, the skyscraper is here to stay because it has something to offer. A minimum footprint, high density, you can really economize and create something good.
But then there is also the other side, the individual homes. Have you designed them as well?
Very few, actually. In my book, Counterpoint, I show a home for two art lovers in Connecticut, which is under construction. And that's, it's fantastic to be able. What a privilege to design a small project where you don't have to, go to government agencies.
Frank Lloyd Wright once proposed something that was very Le Corbusier in thinking for New York. He said that we should build these 2-mile-high buildings in Central Park, and they would contain all the businesses, and then the rest of the city would have one and two family homes.
Well, there again is the architect behaving like God, you know, this kind of authoritarian idea how everybody should live. I think there is a space here for some humility. We need skyscrapers, we need homes. We need kind of a balance in reality.
Do you have some kinds of projects you like doing more than others, skyscrapers as opposed to museums?
Not at all. I take whatever comes my way. You know, everything. I've just completed a shopping center in Switzerland, a mixed use. You know, and I loved working on it because why just relegate those projects to the hacks and to the formula? Why not innovate and create architecture? And after, 4 months of the project, more than 1 million people have come because the architecture sort of lifts the project out into another space.
Because shopping malls generally are very undistinguished as architecture.
Well, they're usually not architecture. They're just some sort of commercial formula. You go from A to B, you shop, and I try to do something else. Respect the economics of it, but create public spaces that where people can enjoy being and introduce the cultural dimension to a shopping center just the way that my museum clients want to introduce the commercial dimension, so they want the shops there to be successful in a museum.
But museums have changed totally. You can't imagine anybody designing something like the Metropolitan Museum of Art today. Now you have to take Richard Serra sculptures and even bigger sculptures and projects into you have to know that they're going to be exhibited in these spaces as well.
It's not only a matter of scale of objects in museums, but museums have become participatory. It's no longer just, you know, going into a black box and looking at artworks. It's a social experience. It's really what art is all about. It's about imagination. It's about the creative. It's not just about the specialist notion of hanging objects with a certain in a certain environment.
And so many museums, I think, going back to the Guggenheim, become works of art in their own right.
I think if a museum is not a work of art, what can we expect of architecture? Since that's what a museum is supposed to do. It's supposed to, it's the muses. It's bringing poetry and philosophy and art into your space and making you part of that dream.
Counterpoint, Daniel Lipskin in conversation with Paul Goldberger, is published by the Monticelli Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. It's not too late to see Garrison Keillor and A Prairie Home Companion live at Town Hall. There are still tickets left to Friday night's performances this month. Ticket information is on the events page at WNYC.org. My guest is Daniel Lipskind, and the book we're talking about is Counterpoint, Daniel Lipskind in Conversation with Paul Goldberger, published by Monticelli Press. It must have been fun talking with someone as sophisticated as Paul Goldberger, an architecture critic who really knows his architecture.
Oh, I had a lot of fun. He's a person with tremendous knowledge, and it was interesting just to answer questions and get into a debate about architecture cities, what the future holds.
And what do you think the future holds?
I think the future holds the fact that we will require architecture to be more and more responsive to us, that architecture is no longer just for the elite somewhere in a boardroom, but that everyone is affected by architecture.
But it's my sense that what's happening with architecture, at least what's happening in New York, is that we come up with these grand plans. You've been part of this, but so have others. Calatrava, for example, his path station downtown. And then it gets cut back. It gets cut back. We don't have the money. And then what we wind up with is something totally different from what we originally thought we were going to get.
Well, look, architecture.
So how important are the economics?
They are very important. Just like water, air, fire, and money. You can't leave it out of the formula, and because it takes a lot of resources to build even a small building. So architects have to be clever enough, I think, to create things which are beautiful but are within a certain limit. Otherwise, they never get built. They're just fantasies.
Now, Calatrava really loves sculpture and exhibits as a sculptor. Weren't you interested in being a musician earlier?
Yes, I was trained. I was a virtuous musician. And I still think that music is probably the most important thing when I design architecture, because those two fields are totally interwoven. Think about it. The sense of orientation is not through the eye. It's the inner ear. Sound, acoustics, the way we relate to space is thoroughly part of a musical experience. And, of course, proportions, harmonies. In architecture, that's why I call the book, by the way, Counterpoint, because Counterpoint is the play of many different melodies simultaneously in harmony.
And you even performed once with Yitzhak Perlman, but I gather you're not playing anymore?
No, I play in architecture. You know, you can't be a virtuoso, you know, instrumentalist while you're doing something else. It's a full-time job. But you know, as I mentioned, music is so close to my heart, and every building has it.
So you just decided to give up music to become an architect? What led you to do that?
Yes, well, you know, I was in the America-Israel, I won the America-Israel Prize together with Yitzhak Perlman. And Isaac Stern, who was the head of the jury, said to me, because I played a strange instrument, the accordion. And he said to me, well, Mr. Liebkin, now you have to, you know, take up the piano. I said to myself, you know, I've learned how to play vertically. Now, horizontally, it's something else. And I took out the pen. And since then, I stayed.
That explains the skyscrapers. But then you decided to stay in academia for a long time.
I didn't decide. I think the academic world is often underestimated because it's a place where you can experiment. And I never wanted to, you know, apprentice myself and work on offices, sort of do it that way. I always hoped that I would be able to do architecture in a different way, and I was lucky to do that.
Well, so many exhibits of work by architects have to do with concepts, buildings that never get made. In fact, there are a fair number in this book as well. And we have
actually, there are 36 projects. 15 of them are constructed, 12 are in construction, and 9 are in planning.
So all of them will be made.
Almost all of them will be made. Yes,
but you can hone those skills when you're working at a school, can't you?
Well, you know, when I started thinking about architecture, the world was pretty boring. You had, you know, the big corporations doing dull buildings, and there was no chance to do interesting things. But life has changed. Architecture has changed. It's attracting different kinds of people. There's a different response, and it's certainly a much more interesting time now than when I graduated.
Your first big project was the Jewish Museum in Berlin. How did you end up designing that structure?
Well, it was a little bit like learning how to swim by being thrown into the Pacific, because I never designed a building before. This was my first building. But
how long had you been teaching?
Oh, many years. I started for maybe 20 years, or I know, 18 years. You know, my wife calls me a late bloomer. This was my first building. You know, I was in the mid-40s when I started it. But you know, there is no mythology in architecture. You really have to know what you're doing. You have to take up the techniques, but you have to do something that is spiritual, something that has a cultural content to it. And that's what I believed, and I was lucky to accomplish it.
But you say that was a difficult project.
Well, it was difficult politically. You know, the museum went through the turmoils of unification of Germany. It went through, you know, different mayors and governments. And at one point it was even unanimously voted down by the government. They don't need a Jewish museum. They need something else. So I was lucky to prevail. And it taught me one thing, that you have to be patient. You have to. Architecture is a marathon. It's not a sprint.
Well, I've been fascinated by how Berlin has dealt with the past. They've left buildings bombed out that I think they should have rebuilt. They've rebuilt buildings that I thought they should have left bombed out. But it tells us as much about how the Germans are dealing with their own history as about what buildings need to be built.
Well, absolutely. I think the Germans are very conscious of history. And I think they are very careful culturally with buildings. So I admire Berlin. It's a beautiful city, and it's of course a city that has to deal with a history that is never going to go away, and at the same time do something which is hopeful, which is interesting, which shows another Berlin.
What about your own history? You were born in Lodz, Poland. Did you right after the war?
Yes, my parents were Holocaust survivors, and survivors of the Soviet gulags as well. And I was born after the war, and I grew up, unfortunately, under communism and anti-Semitism in Poland. And yet it taught me a lot, because Poland is such a great culture as well, you know, with my favorite composers like Chopin and great writers. But it was a tough growing up there.
Now, Poland has changed.
Oh, immensely. In fact, I'm building a building in Warsaw now, the highest residential tower, one of the highest in Europe, right across the Palace of Culture of Stalin, which was the most hated emblem of Soviet occupation. And what a change. Young generation, new generation of people, a new spirit of freedom. It's incredible how the world can change to the positive.
You've designed 3 Jewish museums, including the Jewish Museum in Berlin we just talked about. Were you drawn to those projects because of your own history and your experience with anti-Semitism?
No, it just happened that the Jewish Museum in Berlin, I responded to the competition. It was my first building, as I mentioned, Somehow I was lucky enough to win. Little did I know that winning was the easiest part of that project, that building the building is really the challenge. Just like here at Ground Zero, it's easy enough to win a competition, but to get results, that's what you have to persist and that's what you have to have faith in.
Well, it's been 5 years since you won the World Trade Center design competition. How would you say the project is going? Every time I go by there, I still see just a hole in the ground.
Well, it's a hole in the ground, but it's happening. You know, the master plan for which I'm responsible is happening. It's a complex project to build politically, as you know, emotionally. But what I wanted to do is garner consensus so that this hole can be not just an abyss in the middle of New York, something positive. And it's under construction.
Now, what do you say to people who say that you won the you won the battle but lost the war?
Not at all. You know, I don't believe that it's good to get a totalitarian regime to give you a big piece of land and build an impressive building. I think working in a democracy is tough. I'm a believer in it. You have to sometimes compromise, but I think the results will be inspiring. You'll see the Freedom Tower, the memorial, all the components of the Wedge of Light and the Slurry Wall. It's going to be something spectacular.
How will the finished project be different from your original design?
I think for a layperson, not very different at all. I think you won't be able to see the difference. Of course, everybody who saw those early renderings thought, I will build the whole project. That was never my intent. It is a project with very good architects. You got Foster, you got Rogers, you got many good architects. The memorial, it's about the composition of a city. It's not about a building alone.
But so many political things came to the fore during all of this talk. For example, at the beginning, everybody wanted an art center there. They wanted this to be part of a revival of the downtown area, and then people started getting worried about whether art might be exhibited that would be insulting to the victims of the attack on the World Trade Center. And little by little, things got cut away. And it doesn't sound like it's anywhere near as exciting a project as it was at the beginning.
Look, architecture, you have to let it develop. Not everything is in the architect's control. You know, emotions, politics, you know, there are a lot of that. But I think in a measured way, the spaces which are there will be memorable. Of course, I miss some of the cultural facilities that were supposed to be there, not there. But we are still hopeful, and I think every listener to your program should in a democracy we should voice our opinions. We need a performing arts center. We need cultural activities at Ground Zero because it's not just about offices; it's about people.
Well, we fantasized at one point moving WNYC down to that area, but it's taken so long. We wound up in this facility.
Yes.
Instead, we're not unhappy. This is a great location.
It's a beautiful place. Well, there might still be a future for you there.
My guest is Daniel Libeskind. The book we are discussing is Counterpoint, Daniel Libeskind in Conversation with Paul Goldberger, published by Monticelli Press, with lots of wonderful pictures along with the conversation. And as I said earlier, you can see some of the photos that have been posted on our website. We have the Imperial War Museum in North Manchester, England. We have the Wall Center at Ramat Gan in Israel, and we have an extension to the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. This is was never built, but it's going to be?
Well, you never know.
But you say that if this hadn't happened, you would not have been able to build the Denver Art Museum.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about architecture. It's not just a response to an immediate project. It's a continual research. It's an art form, a civic art form. And when you work on a project, it's never really dead, unless you're just an expedient architect who's just working to get a project, financed. If you work on ideas, then ideas never go out of space.
A listener wants to know if you think a new Penn Station should be designed or built. The old one is kind of we replaced one of the most glorious works of architecture with one of the ugliest works of architecture.
I completely agree with this listener. There was such a heroic, one of the great pieces of architecture there. And I think New York deserves, every city deserves great civic buildings because that's what people use every day.
It is interesting that in New York you enter the city, which has so much great architecture, and you see ugly. You come to one of the airports and then you drive through ugly for a while.
Yeah.
And then finally you get a glimpse of the skyline and you realize, well, I am in a special place. But we really have not thought much about how we greet outsiders, visitors.
That's certainly true. Cities are more than just the icons that we know from the past. We have to do something to contribute to their future revival. And if cities don't compete, they become just museums or old cities.
You and your wife and business partner, Nina, have an office here in Lower Manhattan. Do you live here part of the time?
Of course. No, I live here all the time. I also live on an airplane. But certainly New York is my home, and this is our, you know, central command. But we also have offices in Zurich and in Italy, in Milan.
How much of your time day to day is spent on the World Trade Center project?
It's always in my mind. You know, I pass it every day when I go to work and when I go home. I live very close to the site. I look at it and I think about it, and I deal with it really all the time. It's not a 9-to-5 thing. It's a preoccupation, because, as I often said, mayors and governors, others will pass, but someone has to stay there to care for even the seemingly insignificant details. You know, a street which is 2-3 inches wider than it was before, and that's part of planning something that will be sustainable.
One of the arguments during the planning was that we have to have streets going through that area. Again, they were eliminated when the old World Trade Center was built.
Oh, absolutely. My master plan takes up Fulton Street and Greenwich Street as streets that connect east, west, north, south. You don't want a big podium with abstract buildings. You want a neighborhood. And that's what is at the core of my plan, to create a neighborhood, a place to be, a place 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, not a dead place that works only in certain times of day.
Which is, forgive me for expressing my opinion, is the problem with Battery Park City. It is cut off from the rest of the city by a major roadway, and you have the feeling that that they're saying, don't come over here, and we're not going to go over to your side.
I agree. It's too much of a divide. You want to make a city that is accessible, and you want everybody to be part of this city. You don't want just some people to have access, not others. And by the way, I should mention that I have a book signing at Arkivia Books on Sunday at 3 o'clock, which is on Lexington and 71st Street. And I'll meet people and greet them. And
they'll have heard you here, and perhaps they'll know to ask you all sorts of interesting questions.
Yes, I also have another book signing with actually Paul Goldberger at the Center of Architecture, which is on Wednesday, tomorrow at 6 p.m. So,
Well, what's happened to you? You started off, as we said, an academic for 20 years, and then you had a small operation, and now you have a major international presence.
I often think that I lived my life in reverse. According to the Greeks, you have to first have the active part of your life in the beginning, and then the next part should be a meditation on what you've done. I had the meditative part, where I had nothing much to meditate upon, and now I have to make up for it with work, and it's so much fun to be able to build around the world and work with people that you admire and create something that is there.
Listeners want to know who your favorite architects are.
Well, my architects go right through time. From the architects of the Parthenon, the architects of the cathedrals, the architects of, the Baroque, Borromini, Bernini, the great architects of the Renaissance, Michelangelo, one of our favorite architects, to the architects of the 19th century, Tony Garnier, the great engineers, and of course, Le Corbusier, Mies, Alvar Aalto, the great contemporary 20th century architects.
Well, the ancient architects and the architects of the Renaissance had all these theories about balance. Do you have theories like that?
Definitely. Well,
proportions and balance.
Absolutely. At the center of my architecture is the human being. And the human figure has become sort of unpopular. Most architects design with the computers. They just design shapes and abstractions. But I always go back to what is the human being in a space? It's really about intimacy and a certain kind of communication which can only be given when you think that the human being comes first.
Well, in the in architectural renderings, they always show people at the foot of the building, but it never seems to mean anything. It's just to indicate that the building is in the real world.
It's very rhetorical. Very often people just, in a computer, just put people in. But putting people in is not like that, because the whole space has to echo with a soul. It has to have a emotional impact on you. It's not just about geometries. It's about that connection that goes into the mind and beyond, towards the kind of the spirit of what the world is, where is it going, and how are we connected with those who are not here.
So a philosophy of life. We had Ada Louise Huxtable here recently, and she said that architecture, as far as she was concerned, was the greatest of all the arts. I as an ex-painter, was slightly offended. But
well, every art claims to be the first. But architecture has an advantage that it's really, we are always in architecture. We are always in a landscape. We are always already in the world that has been somehow shaped. Even if we just clear a field, we are doing, it's an architectural gesture. And so we are connected to the world in a deep way through architecture.
And for a long time, architects were painters and sculptors as well. Michelangelo, for example, Le Corbusier.
Oh, absolutely. I think the world of architecture is the world of culture. You can't just be a technician and a bureaucrat and handle lines on paper. You have to have an affinity to the great literature and to the great poetry of the world. Without it, what you build is just a folly.
Counterpoint, Daniel Libeskind in conversation with Paul Goldberger, is published by the Monticelli Press. As I said earlier, we have posted some of the images from the book on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us again. It's
been
great.
Thank you so very much. Thank you so much.
On tomorrow's show, Carrie Fisher talks about her unusual life and what it was like to grow up as the daughter of Hollywood royalty. Also, actress Michelle Williams and director Kelly Reichardt on their new film, Wendy and Lucy. Ralph Fiennes on his role in the movie The Reader, plus the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Ubell, answer your home repair questions. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshick, Sarah English, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Miranda Schaefer, Alex Simons, Leslie Dickstein, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Thank you.